Cradio.
This is Natasha D coming to you for Cradio, cradio.org.au, coming to you from the World Congress of Families, being held in Sydney in May 2013. Now, my guest at the moment is Dr. Brian Scarnecchia. Now, Brian, tell us a bit about your work, what you do whilst you're not in Sydney at a conference.
Very good, yes. Oh, I'm a teacher. I teach at Franciscan University of Steubenville. I'm an associate professor of human life studies and legal studies. I'm also an associate professor at Ave Maria School of Law in Naples, Florida, and I teach origins of constitution, bioethics, property law, and criminal law. So I'm a lawyer by training and profession, but I also have a background in theology. And between the two, I'm able to write on sensitive issues of human rights and bioethics.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier when we spoke that you've written a book. Can you tell us a bit about the book that you've written?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The book is published by Scarecrow Press, a subsidiary of a large international publishing company. It's on bioethics, law, and human life studies. And I deal with all of the major life issues, contraception, abortion, reproductive technology, end-of-life issues, marriage and family. I begin my mode of operation by exploring the Church's teaching on these particular issues, because inevitably my students need to know that. What does the Church say about this? And then I move into what the law says about these issues.
Okay. And perhaps the reasons behind why the Church says and believes what they say and believe.
That's right. That's right. But I look at the key document from the Church that deals with the area. So for contraception, for instance, of course, it's Humanae Vitae. And then for the issue of abortion, well, I mean, there is the Declaration on Procured Abortion, but there's also Evangelium Vitae. The first part of the book, though, deals with the moral principles that underlie all of this. So I deal with Veritatis Splendor, The Splendor of Truth by John Paul II, exploring the foundations of moral theology. And I look at the key moral principles, double effect, and the three moral determinants, and consequentialism. It's about a third of the book, but it gives the key foundational principles in moral theology. And then we move into the life issues.
Okay, excellent. Now, you're here at the conference. I believe you're on a panel. Can you tell us a bit about the panel that you're on and what you're talking about, just so our listeners at home that couldn't get here get to hear a bit of what you were going to say?
Yes. Well, my talk was on human rights mechanisms in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. That's a regional intergovernmental body. It works in tandem oftentimes with the United Nations, but it covers the 10 nations of this Southeast Asia. So one of the things I didn't say about myself is in my other hat is that I'm a president of an NGO, International Solidarity and Human Rights Institute, accredited with the United Nations and consultative status, so that every year I take students to the United Nations, both in New York City at the headquarters and also in Geneva at the UN headquarters, to the Human Rights Council there. And so this paper is born of that work, more than the bioethics work, per se.
Okay. So what are some of the problems in the Southeast Asian region? I believe that child trafficking can be quite a problem.
Oh, my, yes. And child soldiers, and the egregious violations of human rights are legion. Some of the most rogue nations on earth are here. I mean, I don't mean to speak ill of the people of these countries, but their governments are rascals. We're speaking about Burma, we're speaking about Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. So, yes, on the one, see, with ASEAN, that's the acronym for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, they were always founded in 1967. They were always an economic consortium, shall we say, with no real teeth. So they were the slowest of the regional intergovernmental bodies. For instance, the African Union, the EU, the Organization of American States. All of these have more juridical personality, had juridical personality sooner. ASEAN was just a loose confederation of states, and principally, as I said, for economic development. But because of the egregious human rights violations in this region of the world, the pressure was always brought to bear on these governments to do something about these violations, these abuses of human rights. Well, recently, since 2007, and even up until 2012, that pressure has borne fruit. There was a charter created in 2007 that gave ASEAN an independent status apart from whether the governments wanted to hold it in existence or not. So it acquired this juridical personality. Now the United Nations and other governments could send ambassadors to ASEAN rather than to the individual governments. So that was a big step. And then they created a commission for the development of a human rights instrument. And then in 2012, they created a declaration of human rights for ASEAN. Now, you asked about the problems. It's this. And it's not just a problem for ASEAN, but really for the whole culture of human rights around the world. You've got two sets of human rights. You have the, shall we say, authentic human rights, encapsulated in, to a large extent in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations. That reflects the best traditions of many, many indigenous people, many Western governments. As you know, it was born of in the ashes and tears of World War II. It is something of a natural law document. Jacques Maritain and others were instrumental in shaping that document. It's not a perfect document, but for instance, whenever John Paul II or any of the popes would go to the United Nations, they'd always call them back prophetically to the principles, their guiding principles, as laid out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So those are authentic human rights. Well, you've seen since the great, the big UN conferences since the 90s, Cairo, Beijing, and other conferences, the birth of a whole new set of human rights, the kind of human rights that some would say are actual violations of human rights.
For example, reproductive rights.
Sexual and reproductive rights, gender mainstreaming. These rights now, like, shall we say, weeds in a garden, threaten to choke out authentic plants of human rights. Yeah,
that's a good analogy. You've got to get onto those weeds before they take over.
Well, indeed. And now, bringing it into the context of the ASEAN debate, back in 1997, when ASEAN sent a representative to Vienna on its deck, where it was discussing international universal human rights, ASEAN objected, saying that universal human rights are really Western human rights and don't reflect, quote-unquote, Asian values. Well, the United Nations and many Western states simply said, well, that's ASEAN's rogue nations trying to create a buffer so they can pick and choose which of these rights they'll be subject to.
Ways of getting around it.
Yeah. On the other hand, there were some legitimate concerns from ASEAN's member states saying, listen, if by Western values you're speaking of these decadent postmodern values, we want nothing to do with them, and we will hold up Asian values as a shield against your disvalues. So what do you do? You know, on one hand, you don't. So here's the real problem. I mean, obviously, the human rights are universal; they spring from human nature. But if in fact we've now opened the door to the weeds that are really not human rights, but a mockery of human rights, and then we present them all as one package. You can't pick and choose. Take one and all in the United Nations again and again in its soft law documents, its position papers, its white papers, its platforms of action. Keep saying sexual and reproductive rights are human rights. Gender mainstreaming is human rights. Well, if you can't pick and choose amongst your human rights, well, it puts us in a real dilemma. On the one hand, we want to uphold the universality of all human rights. On the other hand, we have to say, well, wait a minute, but some of these human rights really aren't human rights. So there's this tension. Now, it's not just in ASEAN, because this is the same problem that's being addressed in at the Human Rights Council in Geneva. Archbishop Tomasi, the permanent observer of the United Nations to the UN headquarters in Geneva, spoke about this, saying that these new human rights threaten to undermine all human rights, because there's no consensus on these so-called new human rights, sexual and reproductive rights, gender mainstreaming, same-sex marriage, and things of that sort. But that very introduction of them undermines the foundation of human rights.
Indeed. So, now, speaking about same-sex marriage, unfortunately, in the United States, several states have fallen to allowing same-sex marriage into law. Now, being as a professor of law at Ave Maria, how does... when we change the law, how does that impact on society? And changing the law in the area of family, how will that affect the future of the West to come? When you start messing around and changing laws that deal with the fundamental basic level of society, what do we need to look out for? What can that affect?
And this brings up the sort of the chicken and the egg, which comes first, culture or law, or law and culture. It brings up the idea that you can't the pithy aphorism that you can't legislate morality. So true, but on the other hand, you can legislate immorality. What I mean to say is that it's very easy to take air out of a system, like air out of a balloon, energy out of a system. So if you deregulate morality and say that abortion is a fundamental human right, well, everybody goes, well, if that's all the higher the standard is, I'll meet that. But when you try to raise the standard, then you have to put energy into a system. Now, that's very difficult. So law can work mischief with a culture, especially bad law can work a lot of mischief with the culture, because people then are generally no better than what's known as social virtue. The vast majority of people will rise to the level of what's legal, and oftentimes no more.
Yes, even it may not be moral, but because it's legal, they use consequentialism to say that it's okay. It's legal, it's okay.
Well, St. Thomas Aquinas said that in a Catholic culture, in a moral culture, most people will be saved, he suggested, because of the sheer, they go with the stream, and if the stream says, for instance, divorce is bad, well, then they're against divorce. They don't want to be considered naughty. But in a culture that, then he went on to say, but in an immoral culture, people go with the flow and are often no better than that. So that's... So, turning back to the question of same-sex marriage, the first case that really looked at this in a big way was Baker versus Vermont in the United States. So this is the Supreme Court of Vermont, and the arguments that they laid out are seminal, they're key, they're simply being revisited in all these other cases. And here was the distinction that they made, that the law prohibiting the benefits of marriage from people of the same sex, and I don't want to use the word gender because that's a social construct and I'd rather avoid that word, but to deny them the property benefits of marriage when they are similarly situated to heterosexuals is unjust. It is simply unjust. But then, of course, the state of Vermont said, but they're not similarly situated to heterosexuals. There's a fundamental difference. Oh, pray tell, said the Supreme Court. What is this fundamental difference? Well, heterosexual couples are fertile. Oh, really, said the Supreme Court. Tell me about how fertile they are. I mean to say that how many heterosexual couples, by the way, agree that they'll never have children and use everything under the sun to achieve that end? Well, quite a bit, I suppose. Yes. And what is it that you say that's really the problem? Well, you see, it's driving a wedge between parenting and marriage. The idea that sex and children are linked. Oh, really? Is that what you think that heterosexuals today marrying really believe? We don't think that that's the case. Well, I don't know. The argument went on, but basically it's this. With the legalization of, or I should say that the decriminalization and the legitimization of contraception, fundamentally, heterosexuals behave not much differently than homosexuals. Their acts of, shall we say, orgasmic outlet, as our evil genius, Kinsey, would have said, are simply a matter of preference. Neither are fecund. Neither are fertile.
And it's more of a selfish act as opposed to a self-sacrificing, self-giving act, open to life.
Exactly right. And then the Supreme Court of Vermont said, "Oh, and by the way, you were saying that the way lesbians, for instance, become fertile is through artificial reproductive technology, and that that's a bad thing. But then you don't discriminate against heterosexuals that use artificial reproductive technologies. So I'm sorry, your argument is not cogent. The kinds of reasons you want to exclude the benefits of marriage from homosexuals." Really just comes down to sentimentality and tradition and perhaps some religious moral principles, but it has no basis in justice, given the fact that heterosexuals behave no differently than homosexuals, making themselves sterile and using reproductive technologies to achieve fertility. And your law doesn't discriminate against them for that. So those are the same kinds of arguments. So, you know, it's very hard to... pull one log out of a fire and say this log, this same-sex marriage is bad, when the other logs burning in there, contraception or abortion, go on apace. If you remember, contraception is also the justification for abortion. How so? Well, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, said, well, you know, maybe Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion in the United States, was wrongly decided. But we can't reverse it now. Oh, why can't we reverse it now? Well, because, you see, we've become a country that relies upon contraception, and in the case that contraception should fail, on abortion to cover it. And unless we're willing, this is now implicit in the argument, they didn't say this explicitly, but the reasoning is this, unless we are willing to undo contraception and no longer permit it, we must allow abortion. So in the case of same-sex marriage, at the root of these evils lies contraception. That is the defining vice, shall we say, of Western civilization, this retreat from, as you put it, Natasha, a total self-giving, a retreat from the fecund relation, inherently fecund, natural relation of man and woman.
So to go back to your earlier analogy, contraception is like the weed that's overrun the garden, so it's really difficult then to see the beautiful flowers, the fruit-giving flowers.
That's right. The logic that is built into the selfish act of contraception, the logic that's built into the divorce of the unitive and procreative aspect of marital love in contraception is simply working its way out in first in abortion, now in same-sex marriage. And, you know, all the other groupings that are going to come, it isn't simply going to be same-sex marriage. Pretty soon we'll have, you know, other kinds of contractual relationships. These four or five men, women, and perhaps at some point in time, children, and who knows what else next, we'll contract that we have this relationship for a while, and this will call marriage. You know, if you listen to the strategists behind the same-sex movement, they're really not interested in heterosexual marriage. They simply want to see that institution destroyed. Yeah, and but at this point in time, it doesn't behoove them to be honest about it because for political reasons. It's just like Margaret Sanger, who said the reason we have to have contraception is because abortion is so evil, and if women have contraception, then they won't be forced into that evil of abortion.
Did Margaret Sanger truly say
that?
Yeah,
that's in her writing.
The foundress of Planned Parenthood, may God have mercy on her soul.
But it was a ruse, because as soon as we had legalized contraception, then we said, oh, we have to have abortion in case that contraception fails. So this is just manipulation. But unfortunately, once, I don't know how to put it, with an apostasy from Christian values, it's hard to have the eyes of the soul, shall we say, alert to these things. When what is self-evident, that there's a fundamental compatibility and complementarity of man and woman, becomes, oh, that's not so self-evident. I mean, when you have to explain to somebody why cannibalism is wrong, for instance, you've already lost the argument. If it's not self-evident, if you really have to explain it, you're going to have a hard time. I mean, because it isn't just being cogent. Now you have to deal with appetites that have already sort of set in place, and emotions, and blind urges being satisfied. I mean, in the intellectual life, you have two choices. Either, the mind the searches for truth, or the emotions search for justification. And in this case, so often now we're seeing our societal appetites just looking for justification.
Yeah, and justification of self-gratifying acts, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But there is hope. Recently I've been following the trial of Kermit Gosnell, right. And he's just been found guilty of 3 counts of murder, and I believe he's being put away, I think, for 2 concurrent life sentences. So for the people that don't know, this is a man who apparently was trained as a doctor and did despicable things. He ran an abortion facility in a very poor, low socioeconomic area, and has... Anyway, check it out online, but it's not for children. Warning, there will be graphic material. But the good news is that this has been recognised, and this man has been charged. So the law perhaps is moving in the right direction, or at least opening people's eyes to the truth of what this contraceptive mentality can do. As you said, leading to abortion, that's just its natural end, unfortunately. So...
The prosecution of criminal abortion acts is very important. We have to show that what goes on in legal, safe and legal abortion clinics is really the same that went on in back alley abortion clinics. At least in the United States, the kinds of regulations that apply to veterinary clinics, that stringency of requirements doesn't apply to abortion clinics.
They're and given, often with particular political favor, inspections aren't carried out, certain things are overlooked, unfortunately.
So if we could just have laws that would regulate and police the abortion clinics at least as intensely as our animal clinics, I think that would be a huge improvement. It would shut down a lot of them.
And perhaps provide a real choice for women.
That's right.
With more education, and perhaps in the place of some of these facilities, to open up adoption agencies would be my dream.
If we could really give women choice, that would be marvelous. Because studies show that most women surveyed in Europe, for instance, would like another child, but don't feel able because of economic or societal constraints. So empowering women would actually serve the cause of pro-life. Pro-choice, pro-woman would mean pro-life, given... all things being equal. So really, what we see is that the pro-abortion, the pro-choice movement is really in the hands of certain ideological driven individuals that are not so much pro-woman as pro-population control for reasons that are often not so transparent.
Yeah, and also pro-profit.
Pro-profit individually. But behind them stands the more nefarious sorts of colonialism and other sorts. This is the other issue, at least in international relations. And I know Dr. Mosier and others have spoken to this issue very well. That the implosion of fertility in the developing world benefits the first world. Even though the first world would like to say that we're helping to cure poverty by reducing the fertility rate of the developing world, the statistics even of this United Nations and the Guttmacher Institute show otherwise. For instance, there was a study, a book many years ago written by Zbigniew Brzezinski on America in the Technocratic Age. And in one of the footnotes, he noted that back in the late 60s, one of the countries coming out of colonial Africa needed at least a population of 8 million people to undergo an industrial revolution. Well, many of these countries didn't have 8 million people. And they were already sending them contraception in droves. Now, how are you going to industrialize if you don't have the population base to do it? That's precisely what one of our own secret memorandum, NSSM 200, a United States Security Department, Security Council document said that we need to have access, the United States needs to have access to the resources, the hard iron ore, not bulk, the minerals of the developing world, its natural resources. And what stands in the way of our accessing these resources is the growing population of the developing world, and we need to implode their populations, but we can't be obvious about it. We need to go about it through their own homegrown leadership. So at least we be accused of imperialism, colonialism. So, I mean, this is very cruel. This is very cruel what's taking place. I've asked some of the delegations that I've gone to whether they were familiar with the United Nations, these delegations, whether they were familiar with this document, and they didn't deny it. In fact, one, not at the United Nations, but in Manila, the then vice mayor of Manila, Lito Atienza, said, "Tell the Americans, quote unquote, to dump their damn condoms in Manila Bay." Precisely, because, and then he cited this document saying that the reason that they're suggesting that population control is good for our economic development is really because it furthers their economic interests, not our development. So it's cruel. If you think about it, sometimes the only resource of a poor family in the developing world is their children. The extra child will be the one who immigrates, goes to Saudi Arabia, and sends back to the Philippines foreign remittances. Take that child away, and you just simply have a more impoverished family. No, the goal of population control is not the betterment of the developing world, just as the goal of much of the pro-choice movement is really not the empowerment of women. And we owe our time, our age, our society, the obligation to light a candle, to say the truth. Whether anyone listens, we believe that there's an unction. Ratzinger, before he became Pope Benedict, said that there is an unction, an anointing that goes with speaking the truth. And even though the opposition has more megaphones and more microphones and more satellites to disseminate a big lie, there is a power to break through it with truth, because truth carries an anointing from God and from the Holy Spirit. And so your work, Natasha, with your radio station is lighting that candle.
As is yours. And it's been my pleasure to be joined with Dr. Brian Skarnecchia, Light in the Darkness, here at the conference, the World Congress of Families, being held in Sydney, May 2013. This has been Natasha D for Cradio. Check out our website, follow us on Twitter, and like us on Facebook. May God bless you and all your loved ones.
Cradio.org.au